welcome to another episode of Old School Guns. This is episode 50, number 50. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting having done 50 of these, and they all last sometimes plus or minus an hour. So it's great to think that there's 50 hours of content out there. I enjoy doing these. I like having a say. I like being able to express my opinion. I also like to be able to correct things that I see that are misinformation that's out there that's wrong, or information that's being put out there by people who have no idea what they're talking about. So this is really great fun for me. One of the things that I found most interesting is with Podbean, you get some statistics, you know, and you can see what states are downloading and how many and which episodes. Not by person or anything, but maybe the state of California does 2 downloads and you see which episodes they are. But one of the things that's very surprising is that some people have gotten on and they started at episode number 1 and have gone all the way up. I didn't think there'd be a lot of interest in the older episodes, but there are, and so I'm glad for that. Glad people are kind of going through it. You know, the first 45 or so didn't have any music or anything. So I'm hoping the music is a welcome addition. But we got some serious wood to chop today. Of course, you know the terrorist attack in England. Mentioned it the last cast. But, you know, hey, this kind of stuff, the potential out there, it's like, you know, are we really better off now than we were, you know, after 2001 when everybody was scared and saw a terrorist lurking behind every bush and in every alley and behind every tree? You know, I mean, you know, and clearly there, I don't know if there's more attacks. You know, you always see the statistics and say, well, there's this many terrorist attacks in the world or in the United States, and you go some, and you look at some of them and say, wow, I didn't know there were that many, you know. It's all about what gets reported on and all the rest of it. But, you know, the bad people are still out there. The sympathizers, the true believers are still out there. And you have to remain vigilant in what you do. And so that's just one of the realities that we have to live with today. So, you know, expect these kind of things to continue. And, you know, the deal is lean on your elected officials to, you know, pass the kind of laws that can handle this thing. And also, you know, we don't have to be nice to these guys. They're terrorists. They're out there wanting to kill people simply because of the way they look, the country they live in, the language they speak, or the beliefs they have. And these people, you know, don't really deserve a break from us. So don't give it to them. Another interesting part of the news is Mike Bloomberg has entered the presidential race. And I see this as a really positive thing. And here's what's so very positive about that. Bloomberg has been spending money on against, you know, gun-owning Americans, trying to take your freedom and your rights away. Bloomberg's been spending a lot of money to do that, to take those rights and freedoms away. So if he wants to go blow it on a stupid presidential race that he has no chance of winning, I say let him do it. Yeah, Mike, spend it up, man. Spend it up. Because that's less money that's going to go into his weirdo anti-gun things and supporting, you know, the weirdo candidates like he did in Virginia. And that may come back to haunt us. If you did not get out and vote in Virginia, you know, there's going to be some repercussions. And I just hope that enough of the state becomes gun sanctuaries that they kind of get the message. And who knows, maybe they can, maybe there's some legislative remedy that they can block the legislation with. You know, who knows? I don't know that a simple majority is good enough to pass something like that. But we'll see. This is what happens when bad people get into office. A terrible governor, a terrible lieutenant governor, and now we have some terrible legislators. So Virginia is going to have a bumpy ride, at least until next November. And then hopefully then they can right some of this and get it on the correct road. You know, one has to really wonder what the Democrats are thinking. This impeachment process has done nothing except overshadow their candidates. And we now see that, you know, silly Kamala Harris, her campaign is imploding. We also see a couple other ones that aren't doing very well. Booker, half these guys, you can't even keep track of who's in it. The only ones that I think anybody pays any attention to are Biden, Warren, this Buttigieg guy, and that's about it. Tulsi Gabbard a little bit. But, you know, the rest of them, who cares? And they're basically, if they're not really functionally out of the race, then they're collapsing. And they're done. This guy Deval Patrick, who just has apparently jumped in the race, nobody really remembers him other than he was an Obama crony, and, you know, maybe outside of his state, he doesn't know anything. I get the feeling he's running for vice president. Some of these guys must be thinking that, well, who's ever the nominee, I'll kind of be in there for vice president. But, yeah, they're doing very poorly, and they're being overshadowed by something that is really helping their opponent. I mean, this is galvanizing support behind Trump, in my opinion, just from what I see and what I hear. And a lot of the public is now swaying, saying, yeah, this is BS. The Russia thing was BS. This is now BS, too. In fact, the guy who's being most seriously hurt by impeachment is Biden, not Trump. It's Biden. You can sit there and argue back and forth over these people who've testified. Most of them are people disgruntled with Trump. And the State Department is filled with people like this. They are for every president. What the American public really doesn't know or get to see is how disgruntled and how much carping and complaining goes on under every president by the State Department, by what we've now labeled as, in some ways, the deep state, these career civil servants who think they know everything better. There's always tension in between the political appointees and the people who are there for a career. The people who are there for a career think they know everything. And the political appointees are just big-time supporters who are getting a payback. And, you know, that's how that is. That's why you can always find all these people who come out and will testify against any president. They would do it against Obama, Bush, the whole thing. And I say that because I worked closely with the State Department in the past. And you know, you just see it up front. It's there. I just don't think that the American people buy into it. They kind of get that these people are, you know, disgruntled. They're saying conflicting things. And the Republicans aren't really allowed to call the witnesses that are going to exonerate Trump. Although they will, if this thing comes down to a Senate trial, there's going to be so many pro-Trump witnesses that they're just going to eviscerate this case. So, you know, that is going on, but the guy really getting damaged is Biden, because everybody knows, no matter which way you slice this, no matter how you spin it, no matter how you look at it, Biden's kid is an influence peddler and was ripping off the people of the Ukraine. And here we are, you know, and Trump's deal is, hey, if we're giving them $3 million for energy, we don't need them paying Hunter Biden $150K a month, you know. That's just kind of what it is. And people will see that, saying, yeah, this guy knew nothing about the energy business, is basically a ne'er-do-well. But because of his last name and who his daddy is and was, he gets this fat cat deal. And a lot of people aren't going to like that. This is damaging Biden. This is swamp antics at its best. So I just sit there and go, yeah, go for it. You know, I just want to go ahead and, you know, keep hurting yourselves. Go ahead and do that. Plus, you know, Schiff and Pelosi just look like fools. They look like complete fools. Pelosi probably knew better, but she didn't have the moral courage to stand up and say, no, we're not going to do this. She didn't stand up to these punks who are just bomb throwers and want to burn the whole place down. I mean, you know, we have elected politicians in Washington who hate America, hate everything it stands for. They hate the military, and they want to create a socialist utopian state. And we've got these people there, and these are now tied into the deep state, the people who know better. And this is a very, very frightening thing. I would be very, very leery and very, very upset about these kind of people if they were representing me. And the people of California, you got to wake up. You got to wake up at some point and realize what's going on. And you know, it's been a long time, but in California, a lot of the races at a general election are between two Democrats. Republicans don't even have a candidate who, quote, qualifies. So, you know, you got to kind of look at that and say, is that really a good thing to have happen? And I would say absolutely not. It's something that never thought we'd see, but we're down to one-party states, California being the prime example. And, you know, it is very bad because that one party is going to factionalize into, you know, some other very, very strange mutations of a political party structure that we've never seen. It's going to have factions that are going at it harder than they go after the Republicans, who really don't count anymore. Okay, let's get away from politics. Sometimes when you're dealing with politics, you feel like you need to go take a shower afterwards. I mean, it's so disappointing. But let's get to some better stuff. Recently completed my range officer certification with USPASA, the United States Practical Shooting Association. I've kind of dabbled with that a little bit. Not a great experienced competitor by any means, but actually a neophyte. And one of the reasons I wanted to get certified was the class came up. It's not terribly expensive. It's a nice certification to have. And the best part of it is it makes you a better competitor. If you know the rules from the range officer side and know what the usual pitfalls are, it's going to make you a better and a safer competitor. So that's why I did it. I kind of came out of it with some mixed feelings. And I guess the mixed feelings are that I remember the birth of combat shooting. I was in school. I was a high school kid. And so I remember seeing it starting out, and it was kind of interesting. And I remember reading quite a bit about it because it was the big deal, especially if you were following Jeff Cooper, who was kind of the intellectual father of this sport. You know, you kind of were following that and kind of seeing it as it progressed and developed. And where it really started was sort of a martial exercise of how can I engage multiple targets or engaged threats with a pistol, you know, with a pistol. And pistol shooting was big back then. They didn't really do any tactical rifle back then. It all started with pistols because Jeff Cooper was a pistol guy. He created the modern technique and on and on. And the first guns that they used were simply nothing more than an accurized Colt 1911 with a, you know, good fixed sight that they could shoot basically point of aim at the kind of ranges they were doing, which same ones now, about 15 yards. You know, so that's kind of what it is. And as a matter of fact, if you wanted to buy an off-the-shelf gun to do that, because the Colt still at that point had the kind of the World War II looking sights, which aren't bad but weren't really what people were looking for, you could get a Gold Cup, and you could compete successfully with one of those. It had the, you know, target adjustable sights. As time went on, of course, things started to develop where they got higher visibility. Fixed sights. Then it, you know, got into the 38 Super craze, where all of a sudden they realized, hey, you can carry a lot more rounds in a 38 Super. And then we started getting into the ridiculousness of breaks and, you know, all the rest of it that has followed up until now, where the guns that are suited for the sport, the top end guns in the sport, look nothing like a defensive pistol anybody would ever use. And you know, with the way the optics are arranged and the giant mag funnel, the brakes and all the other stuff, and the holsters have become completely something you'd never wear on duty, you know, a lot of the holsters. And I realize there are different divisions where they've tried to segregate that, and that's probably one of the more confusing parts of it, is there's so many divisions in it now that you have to really see what you're doing. And of course, you go to a match, if you want to shoot in the what is amounted to the 1911 division, the single stack division, you got to have enough shooters to even put together a deal to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of works out. But it definitely has gone from something that was designed to be a something of a training vehicle or have some training value to something which clearly it does not have now. Even the more lower end kind of practical type of rigs that people use are nothing that you really see on duty anywhere. And thus, I guess that's gave the rise to the IDPA, you know. So, which is a competing organization which has very similar things but uses, quote, what they consider to be more street-worthy carry guns, you know. So, it's definitely an interesting world to be in. If I do any real competing in it, which I'm kind of up in the air on, they actually have a pistol carbine class, which I kind of like that because I will tell you that, you know, they have very, very stringent, and they even say in the training, they're draconian rules. I mean, you break the 180, you get a disqualification for the match, and you're done. You go to a safe area, unload everything. You unload everything, go to a safe area, pack your stuff, and goodbye. You know, you're done. You drop your pistol. That happens. Same thing. If you have your finger on the trigger while you're doing anything but acquiring a target and shooting, you're done. So if you're reloading, moving, or doing anything else, and your finger gets into that magazine or the trigger guard, you are done. So most people though are a little bit better with the carbine. He probably has fewer disqualifications for that, or what they call a DQ, when they basically say, "Up." You're done. You're done. DQ. You're out. So, I might do that. And of course, now that means you, of course, have to have one. I've got an old Ruger carbine that I've talked about on the cast before, and actually, it's, you know, the old model PCC. Nobody's really interested in them anymore. Takes the old Ruger P series mags, and I've got a few of those laying around. So everything's cool with all that. But of course it doesn't have an optic. It has, you know, some almost AK looking iron sights is really the way you kind of describe them. So I kind of look at that and I was deciding, well, do I really want a optically sighted carbine, or do I want to just stick with the iron sights? Because if you've listened to other podcasts, you know I have predicted a counter revolution in iron sights, and maybe this is maybe this is the place where it starts. I don't know. So I'm going to do some shooting with my iron sights and see. And then I do have the new Ruger carbines come with a Picatinny rail already on the top. I don't know if it's molded into the receiver or if it's, you know, screwed and Loctited on there. I don't know how that really works. I haven't seen one up close. But on the old one, we have to put it, you have to get one that fits over the scope mounts that they have there. So, and it's the same one for the Ruger 10-22 and a few others. So, you know, we'll see. I'll shoot it with the iron sights first to see how it feels. And then I might try an optic, but right now, I'm really leaning towards the iron sights. If I can make those work, that's probably the way I'm going to go. Because I think that it's inherently faster, it's shorter range, than trying to acquire a dot, then acquire the target. If you can just line up right on the iron sights and put it into the A zone, then you're probably going to be doing a whole lot better. So we'll see. At the ranges we're talking about with these, I think iron sights will probably work. But we'll see how it shakes out. But it's a very, very demanding, very, very demanding sport. Physically, not so much. Mentally, it is very difficult because it's basically built on freestyle, which is, you know, kind of in keeping with what Cooper would have liked, which is you have a tactical problem and you solve it your own way. It's not you have to step here, then you step there. There is some of that, and there are fault lines that you can't cross and shooting boxes you must stay in and some of this other nonsense. But for the most part, you can solve the tactical problem the way you wish. And that's a good and a bad thing. I think we'll see how the design goes. Some of the designs look very odd to me. So I'm sure that it's possible to completely blow a stage just by having the wrong strategy going in. because it's a game and it's not a tactical problem, it's a game problem. So it's a lot different than what real life would be. I think towards the end of his life, I think he kind of distanced himself from USPA SA simply because it becomes such a gamer sport and becomes such a gamer deal. I think he was much dismayed by that, and I'm just kind of guessing. I'm remembering some of his writings and some of his things where he is kind of, you know, stepped away and said, well, it's become now dominated and turned into something else, which it has been. And like all shooting games nowadays, it's ruled by two things. It's ruled by the clock, and it's also ruled by, you know, some steel targets. And you know, if you really want to slow down a competition, score a lot of paper targets. And the scoring that you have on this is a very, very difficult type of scoring to do. You know, as far as, you know, what constitutes a zone hit, and the number of, where it gets, the hits are one thing, but it's hits, misses, and then hitting things that shouldn't be hit. It can get a little convoluted. So the scoring can be difficult, and of course it factors time in also. So it's pretty much a kind of a multi-scoring environment, not strictly just time, but it's a time plus a score. And the steel targets mitigate some of that, because you either knock it over or you don't, you know. So you don't, they score themselves essentially by whether or not they fall over completely. It's very interesting. But at the same token, it's also, you kind of look at it and go, I don't know. Being a range officer doesn't look like it would be a lot of fun to me. It looks like you're the street enforcer for these very draconian rules. And it's not that I disagree with the rules. I don't really like a game that's ruled by the clock. You know, because when that happens, the timer is the root of all evil. And here's all evil. All evil is that our nature of as human beings is, if we can gain an advantage and gain that extra quarter second, we'll do it. That extra tenth of a second. And in matches where there's money and prizes up for grabs, all of a sudden this becomes serious. Very, very serious. And local club matches, I'm not sure, where there's nothing to be gained, that's probably a little more relaxed. But you know, people will go for any competitive advantage they can. What happens is that can force them to make mistakes, and that's how a gun gets dropped. That's how the 180 is broken. It takes that momentary lapse of trying to gain that tenth of a second advantage, causes them to make a mistake, which can cost them the whole match when they get kicked out. So things ruled by the clock are not necessarily the greatest things to be a part of. So I really don't care for that very much. What I do like is younger people are doing it, and there's some really good equipment out there and good things. You know, I think there's also, you know, it's a little better in the production class and some of this. A lot of the real race guns really aren't there, but I think it's a, it'll be an interesting thing to investigate. I'm much more of a tactical guy, and I would much rather be doing the kind of two-gun matches you see on in-range TV, to be blunt. That's kind of where I like to be. Now, where I can't be with them is, I know these guys are a bunch of red hots, and they want to throw kettlebells around and all that, and that's unfortunately something I cannot really do. I could throw a light kettlebell, but I don't know that I could throw the big kettlebell, you know, 20 times to do that. I might have to pass on a stage like that. But I kind of like two-gun. I'd kind of like to see two-gun matches which are safe, but which are a little more tactically focused with tactical equipment, and not as racy or showing. I don't need the fancy, the little bike jersey, which looks, you know, goofy in my opinion. It makes it look like they're trying to appeal to spectators or something, and I don't really need that. I'd rather wear old fatigues. combat boots and some combat equipment just to see it, you know, just to use it, just for the fun of using it. So that's where I am with all that. USPASA is a very, you know, it's a good discipline. The people who shoot it seem to be very, very good people. But whether it's my cup of tea or not will remain to be seen. But it is a nice qualification to have. So I'm really pretty excited about that. That's a good thing. And perhaps, you know, you meet new people and can make new friends through something like that. That's squared away also. Well, let me see. Got a couple of other things going on here. One is the final season of The Man in the High Castle was on. That's, you know, a very interesting show, especially if you like weapons. You like seeing, you know, hey, what does the Resistance use? You know, and you see a Thompson here and there. And later on in the series, of course, you see some AKs and PPSHs and some of these other things are very, very interesting. And I always, of course, appreciate, you see how different the world could have been. Right? You know, we came very close to how different all of our upbringings and where we would be today and how things are could have been very, very different. World War II is really, although there's a lot of material out there and everything, it's really underappreciated how close it was to defeat. It's really, really amazing. The people who knew it the best were the people who lived through it. And you never hear the phrase anymore, but I can remember all the adults, they would talk about during the war. They would say, during the war, this happened. During the war, we did this. During the war, it was this. The war was World War II. It wasn't Korea. It wasn't Vietnam. It wasn't anything else. The war was World War II. It was not World War I. It was World War II. And they lived through the war. And, you know, those people clearly, very, very clearly understood that we could have lost, that it could have been something that we lost. And, you know, a lot of times we had to buy time, so our industrial capacity and our training, our force generation, the ability just to create infantry divisions and air forces and all these other things that we were using, naval strike forces. You know, we needed time to build that stuff and to get the men in it and get them trained so that we could defeat the enemy. And, of course, it also comes down to, what if Germany had to develop the atom bomb? What if the Japanese had? You know, we were very fortunate that we had it and they did not. Or else it would have been a very, very different world. So that's a very interesting show. I enjoyed it very much and think that, you know, it was really a great piece of television. Makes you think a little bit. And, of course, on previous podcasts, I'd spoken of the movie Midway. Absolutely great movie, just to reiterate, and a movie, it will go basically ignored and unheralded, but among military buffs and historians and people who enjoy a well-made movie about a historical event, it will definitely be one of the best ones. It will definitely be remembered and will be a movie that people will refer to. It's much better than the 1974 iteration of the movie that had, you know, kind of the soap opera aspect to it, you know, and a few other things. But this concentrates the suspense where it really needs to be, and it really talks about the courage. And, you know, I think that's what we need. You know, that's definitely what we need. Great movie. So it'll be interesting to see if it gets any kind of recognition. My suspicion is it will not get any recognition, so there you go. Okay. All right, we're now going to start the my favorite part of the show, which is a question and answer period. And so the first question I have is, what do you think of the Browning High Power? Okay, Browning High Power, GP-35... You know, there's a bunch of different designations for it. It goes down as, a lot of people talk about it, well, this was John Browning's last design. And it really, I guess you could call it that. But I think that's kind of some false attribution also. Browning died in 1926. And he was clearly working on a new pistol. There was, I think, a French army solicitation for a new service pistol. And he was working on one. And I think his contribution, and I'm just guessing because nobody really knows, but I'm just guessing that his contribution was the improved barrel link, the fixed barrel link design that the Browning High Power uses vis-a-vis the 1911. There's no little swinging part in there that, you know, when you're field stripping or reassembling a 1911, you have to make sure that little swinging link is linked up before you put the slide stop back in. Well, they don't have that in the Browning High Power. It's just there and the slide stop goes back in. I think that was probably his innovation. I have read in places that his assistant, a man named, and nobody gets this right, Didonné Saïve, and Mr. Saïve basically also designed the FN-49 and the FN-FAL, and probably other things that we don't even know about. But Saïve was the one who came, basically put that arrangement inside of a kind of an envelope that looks like the Browning High Power with the 13-shot staggered magazine. So it became the first high-capacity semi-automatic pistol, what we would call high-capacity. Nowadays, of course, 13 rounds is not very impressive. You know, I think they were doing the SIG 365 or something on one of the YouTube channels. It's like, that holds 13 gun, 12 or 13 in the gun itself, and it's a subcompact, you know, very compact 9mm. So, you know, 13 rounds is not very impressive. But the gun has a lot of really good attributes. It has one attribute I hate, but it has a lot of good attributes. It's very, you know, for a 9mm service pistol, it's quite accurate, actually. It's very good. And in fact, some of them were even outfitted with adjustable and even target sights. You know, that's pretty nice. The next thing that's pretty impressive with it is the trigger pull is pretty decent. It's usually muddled, though, because it has a magazine safety, which was some sort of a military specification. Some people have taken those out, and it improves the trigger pull. Some people just leave it in there. But the bottom line is, you take the magazine out, the gun doesn't shoot, doesn't do anything. And that's not the magazine safety is not something that proliferated like crazy. Most people saw it, didn't like it, and so it kind of died on the vine there. And that's the only thing about it I really dislike is the magazine safety, simply because it messes with the trigger pull. Most of the time it doesn't matter, but it does make the trigger pull a little more difficult because just the way it's designed and how it works. The bore is a little high, like you would expect an auto pistol, like the Smith & Wessons are, like some of these are. So the muzzle does flip a little bit, but it's a good heavy all-steel design. So it doesn't, especially when it's, you know, loaded with cartridges, that the first couple of cartridges you fire, don't generate a whole lot of recoil. A little bit of muzzle flip, but not a whole lot of recoil. Very robust, very simple, very reliable. And it may even still be in service today. I know I saw one or two in Iraq. So, and I can't remember who had them. It may have been Canadians. It may have been someone else. I think they've been largely replaced by Glocks in British service. And I could be mistaken there, but I think it's Glocks. But the Browning High Power is an excellent design, works very well, a good design for, you know, the average shooter. It's still a very good design, and clones are still being made, and I'm sure, I haven't looked it up, but I'm sure that if you look on Wikipedia, they've got probably a list of current users, which is probably, you know, fairly accurate anyway. Good pistol, nice pistol. Is it going to, among traditionalists, it will always be popular. It will not be popular among competitive shooters or anything because it, believe it or not, it actually has a limited magazine capacity now because almost everything you get, you know, even 15 rounds is pretty passe now. So 16 rounds with one in the spout and 15 in the magazine. That's pretty passe. You can usually get 17 and plus one. You know, they always call it that plus one, the one in the spout. So, and of those, you can get extended ones. So you can go into 20 rounds of 9mm, which is another 7 rounds. So it really has only got the capacity of two-thirds of what the modern pistols can bump themselves up to. So it will never be a popular gun for competitors, and it really never was. To go back to the USPSA deal, when that first started out, I was in high school, and I got my hands on a Browning High Power, and I remember I won the first match I was in because I didn't have to reload on any of the stages. They were like revolver-centric, and of course people had to reload those things very slowly, or they had 1911s. There was one or a couple of those, but they ran out of shots. I had twice as many shots. I had the magazine capacity, and it was such a primitive match. They didn't even have the power factor or any of that other stuff. And I can remember one guy was just red in the face. How did he phrase it? You know, it was just the unfair advantage of having this extra capacity. And, you know, I kind of went back to, at that time, Cooper had said, you know, it's best to have an unfair advantage in a gunfight. So I thought this guy was pretty much a whiner, and he was. This was such a primitive match. There were a couple guys in there with single action revolvers with the predictable, you know, disastrous results of they couldn't complete anything, and once they got through their 6 rounds, they couldn't reload fast enough, and on. But anyway, that was my deal with the Browning High Power. I've always liked it, always admired it, always thought it was very well made, and even the clones were very well made. A good, solid military gun, and not really obsolete, but definitely its capacity and just a few other things are working against it. And I think just the cost of it is going to preclude anybody from adopting it. That and its age, you know, it's so much cheaper to go with one of the polymer Wonder 9s that's where people are going to go. Okay, next question is for shooting 5.56 ammunition. Do you prefer the steel cased, and I insert Russian stuff in there, or do you prefer the brass cased, and if so, why? Okay, this is pretty easy. I shoot basically 55 grain, unless for some reason I have to shoot a match load or something. I shoot 55 grains. Frankly, I've never had a problem with the steel case stuff. I don't really care for it. It seems to shoot a little dirtier, but that's just an impression, and I don't know that I could state that with any real authority, but it seems to shoot a little dirtier, so I don't really care for it. Where I come down is, when you basically price it, and you look at, say, 200 rounds worth, really the price delta between the steel and the brass case stuff is really about $5. And for that $5, you get a copper jacket, a lead core bullet, and you get a brass case. And, you know, over 200 rounds, that's a very reasonable cost, and I would just rather go with brass. I mean, now I shoot exclusively in 7.62x39. You know, I shoot exclusively, you know, the Russian stuff, you know, because that comes in. It's designed for it. It works well, and everything's fine. In 9mm, the Russian stuff works fine. You don't even have to worry about the cartridge cases. You know, they pop out all over the ground somewhere, and, you know, when they do their raking, when they rake the range, they'll just rake them up, and you don't have to worry about picking them up and promising yourself that someday you'll reload the things. But and they're cheap enough. I think it's probably worthwhile, although, you know, it's a few bucks here and there. So that's kind of how I do it. I would never, and I've said this before, I would never really use it in don't use it in Garand style rifles. They don't have the right pressure point deal, all that. It works fine. Steel cased 5.56 and steel case 7.62 by 51 NATO work fine in H and K style weapons. I think H and K style weapons were designed with the Eastern Front experience in mind, and they knew that if they're in a slogging war, they may have steel cased ammo that's not very good quality, and they designed a rifle that would shoot it. DSA says do not shoot that stuff in their FNFALs, but they've done it and they've been reasonably successful. But I would heed their advice and not use it. So that's basically how I look at these things. If you can get an economy out of it and it doesn't seem to be bad ammunition, then I would use it. But I would be very careful. I don't really want any of the their 308/762 by 51 NATO round. Wouldn't use it in a M1A. Wouldn't use their 30-06 in a Garand. You know, there's too much other ammo out there you can get reasonably priced, and you know, you can go to PPU and get some better stuff. So that's how I feel about that. Kind of on the fence with 5.56. I kind of fall onto the brass side because it's not that much more expensive, a few bucks. For 9mm, I do like the steel case stuff because I can just shoot it, forget about it, and go on. And all I'm doing is training with that stuff anyway. I wouldn't use it for defense, but I'd use it for training. And the other stuff I would only use in an HK style weapon, not a Garand style weapon at all. Okay, here's another question. This comes from a guy who is a firearms owner, and he's pistol, not really rifles, but pistols. He said, when I walk my dog in the morning, I need a 22 caliber pistol, low cost, because I walk the dog very early in the morning before I go to work, sometimes as early as 5 o'clock in the morning, and there's a lot of nocturnal creatures around, plus potentially coyotes or some other animals out there that could do us some harm. Now, I walk in an area that has houses, so it's not like I'm walking in a neighborhood, but there are houses and things close by, so I want something with low noise signature, very low cost, but something that I can carry and protect myself and my dog with. And I do live in a constitutional carry state, so carrying it is no problem whatsoever. I don't need a permit. Okay, a couple different things here. First of all, you know, the answer is really, really pretty easy on this one. If you want low-cost revolver, go with the Heritage Rough Rider. Yes, it's single action, but you know what? You're going to carry 5 or 6 shots. That's what it's going to be. If you're limiting yourself to 22, that's a much better option than probably trying to go with a 22 automatic. If it has to be an automatic and you can afford a little bit more money, you know, Walther does make a 22 caliber PPK. But for that reason, I would, and that's a good gun. That's a good choice. But I would go with the Heritage Rough Rider. Just simply, this is the point where a gun just becomes a tool. And the tool is to keep, you know, something bad away. And you don't necessarily want to create a lot of noise. You don't necessarily, you know, want to blow a hole in something. Or else you would just carry your M9 with a hollow point and blow a hole in the coyote. But you just might need to have a gun. You just might need that. Because while you're trying to egress away from anything that's causing you a problem, they may come after you. But a 22 would probably stop, at least dissuade a coyote or something else from doing that. The pain and the noise would probably dissuade them. So what the limitation is, I would get a Heritage Rough Rider. Chances of needing more than 6 shots seems very remote to me. So, and it's a small enough gun you can carry. Kind of carry it in a little waist hole. I'd get a cheap Hunter holster or get a cheap Walmart holster. I hate saying that because I hate spending money in Walmart. But I'd get a cheap holster. You know, you're only wearing it for an hour a day at the most. You know, walking your dog. So, you know, just get a cheap holster, slap it on, go with it. Take the gun out of the holster periodically, put some grease, you know, put some oil and grease on it, keep it from rusting away, and there you are. You know, you've got the simple answer. There is getting a gun that is not going to be that is much more of a tool than it is a treasured object or an object of, you know, really great value or anything else. You know, so that's what I would do. That's what I would use for that. Okay, here's another question, and it's about one of my favorite guns in 1911. So let's talk about this one. And the question is, I received a 1911 A1 style pistol made by Kimber as a gift. When I shoot it, it jams about every other shot, and the slide seems to be very difficult to pull back. It seems like there's a lot of resistance, and I am an experienced 1911 shooter. I use some in the military, and I've used some comparatively recently, and I have a Springfield XD in 45 caliber, so I'm not unfamiliar with pistols, and I'm not unfamiliar with 45s or 1911s. But this seems to be difficult. What should I do? Okay, this is always one of those difficult things of a gun's malfunctioning and narrowing it down what it can be. Conventional wisdom is very simple. The first thing I would do is change magazines and change ammunition. So if you've got a box of, and you never know what ammunition people are using, it could be cheap. You know, some of these European guns will take, like, maybe his XD shoots cheap steel-cased ammo without a hiccup. And then when it goes into this 1911, hey, it's not working. And it could be just that gun does not like that particular brand of ammo. So I would change two things. I would use another magazine, see if it does it with another magazine, and see if it also does it with a good quality brass-cased ammo. See if that solves the problem. If that does not solve the problem, and this is where it gets dicey, when he states that the slide seems to be difficult to pull back, that leads me to believe that there may be too powerful a recoil spring in there, and that may be causing the jam also. So I would probably go to Brownells and get some different weight recoil springs and try those and see if that eases it up. If not, if that really doesn't make a difference when you're retracting the slide, then I think you really have to look at two things. The easy answer is lubrication. And, you know, is there any lubrication in there? Because people shoot guns without lubrication. So, you know, you got to make sure that the gun's lubricated. The other thing to do is, at that point, if the gun's been lubricated, and the guy's an experienced shooter, you know, he probably knows this. So I would say if the gun lubrication is good and changing out recoil springs does not make a difference, then you have one of those wonderful problems that happens. The 1911 is a design made by more manufacturers than you can count. Most of them are usually made to about the same sort of specifications. But some are not. Some are a little bit different, and some companies' manufacturing methods are different. Sometimes they're using, you know, cast or NIM parts. There could be a whole variety of things. The only way to solve that is to either send it back to the manufacturer and tell them that the gun doesn't work very well and tell them what the problem is, or go to, what I would do is take it to a gunsmith who is familiar with 1911s, who can probably figure out, maybe he's seen this problem before and can cure it very, very simply. That's what I would do. It sounds like, if I had to bet money, I don't think that the ammunition magazines or recoil springs are going to make a difference. And I'm sure the gun is probably lubricated. And even if it's not, that shouldn't really make a difference. I would tend to guess that there's a specification problem in there where there's some tolerances that maybe something is on the one rail is on the tight end of the tolerances and the other is on the loose end so that they're almost the same size. They're so close that there's a lot of friction and it's and very difficult. And lubrication will not overcome that. You might have to have a gunsmith do some very judicious filing and fitting of the slide to the frame. The other possibility could be that maybe there's a part in there somewhere that's dragging on the slide and it's just not worn it down yet. That's a little bit of a possibility. So these are all things that you have to take into account. And one of the explanation kind of in parentheses in the question was this pistol was a gift. The unit had returned from combat zone and basically bought a batch of pistols that were kind of personalized to the unit with the crest and all these good things on it. And everybody was able to, you know, kind of kick in and get one of these things at a pretty reasonable price. Yeah, you never know. Maybe you never know. It could have been that just when they were doing this batch that they may have missed a little bit of the fitting or function, or they were never really checked because they were commemorative style pistols. So anyway, that's what I would do. Well, this ends another edition of Old School Guns, the 50th episode. And as always, we're on Podbean and iTunes. And until next time, this is Old School Guns out.